Welcome back to the deep dive. Okay, today our goal is really specific, super rigorous, actually. We're doing an intense review of how money supply works, the institutions, monetary standards. Basically, think of this as crucial prep for your EC3115 monetary economics exam. We're totally skipping the basics, functions of money like medium of exchange, store of value. Forget that for now. We're focusing purely on the mechanics, the plumbing, really. Credit creation, how banks actually work, and the big levers the authorities pull to control the money supply.
That's exactly it. Yeah, for this deep dive, we've pulled together the key ideas from your core readings. We're covering everything from, the nitty-gritty of bank balance sheets, like the accounting, right up to the big macro problems, things like, do monetary aggregates actually tell us anything useful? And that whole issue of time inconsistency in policy, our aim is really to link the theory you've been studying to, well, the often messy and sometimes paradoxical reality of how monetary control actually happens or doesn't happen.
Okay, so let's unpack all this. It's dense stuff. We'll kick off with what financial intermediaries actually do, their essential function, and the risks they juggle. Then we'll get right into the bank's balance sheet, that identity. We need to really focus on mandatory reserves there. And then, yeah, the bulk of our time has to be on the monetary authority's toolkit, specifically controlling the monetary base and, crucially, those complex, sometimes really counterintuitive effects of changing reserve requirements. Right, let's start with the banks, their fundamental role. I mean, they're not just safe boxes for cash, are they? They're kind of the engine room for credit creation. So what's their basic position as financial intermediaries?
Well, their position is right in the middle. They're mediating between two quite different needs in the economy. On one hand, you've got savers, depositors, people like you and me, maybe. We want safety, we want liquidity, so we make these very liquid short-term claims on the bank. And on the other side, you have borrowers, often firms, maybe households wanting a mortgage. They need capital for the long haul, for investment. The bank's job essentially is to take those liquid short-term claims from savers and transform them into illiquid long-term assets for the borrowers.
Ah, okay. And it's this transformation process that allows commercial bank debt, these deposits, to function as what we call credit money. Why is it that a simple bank transfer, just moving credit on an account, is accepted globally as payment, unlike, say, an IOU from a company?
Yeah, that acceptance, it's really a testament to, well, institutional confidence and utility, frankly. When you put money in the bank, what you hold is a liability of that bank. It's their debt to you. So when you pay someone, say, electronically, it's that liability, your claim against the bank, that actually moves. And people accept it because the bank offers really valuable services around it, safekeeping, secure transfers, accurate bookkeeping, all that stuff. These services essentially transform what is just a debt instrument into a super efficient way to pay for things.
But underlying all of that, as the readings stress, it's just confidence, pure confidence.
Absolutely. That's the bedrock. The whole system hinges on everyone believing universally that the bank is sound, that it will honor that deposit obligation instantly, on demand, no questions asked. If that confidence even flickers, if there's a whisper that the bank might fail or can't meet its short-term debts, then that specific bank's liability, its deposit, it stops being money immediately. It's this confidence that gives credit money its power, that makes it different from just any old corporate debt. Hashtag tag 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 1.2, the mechanism of maturity transformation.
Okay, so that leads us right into maturity transformation, which sounds like it's, well, vital for finance, but also kind of inherently risky. We're talking about a mismatch in timing, right? Maturity mismatch.
Oh, the mismatch is stark. Yeah. Look
Yeah.
at the bank's liability side, your deposits. They are, by definition, short term. You can demand your money back right now. The bank promises that liquidity. You could say the average maturity of bank liabilities is measured in, I don't know, days, maybe even hours for some types of accounts.
Okay, contrast that with the other side, the assets, the loans.
Total opposite. The assets are typically very illiquid and long maturity. Think about the classic example. A big company borrows a load of money from the bank to build a new factory. That company is probably looking at a, what, 10, 20-year repayment plan. The money the factory generates to pay back the loan, that comes in gradually, steadily over a really long time horizon. But the bank is funding this decades-long project using money that could technically walk out the door tomorrow morning.
That really does sound like a recipe for potential disaster. I mean, if this transformation is so essential for the economy, for growth, why do regulators even allow this mismatch? Doesn't it just make the system incredibly fragile, vulnerable to bank runs?
That is the essential trade-off, and this is a critical point for your exam. You really need to get this. The transformation is vital because, well, without it, where would long-term capital come from? Savers, generally, want short-term liquidity. But big projects, like building factories, buying houses, R&D, they need long-term funding commitments. Banks bridge that gap. They make it possible for the economy to allocate capital effectively across different time horizons.
Right, but the bank isn't doing this out of charity. They have to make money on this risky function somehow. How does the transformation itself generate profit?
Okay, the profit, the margin, it comes from the difference, the spread. It's the difference between the yield they earn on those illiquid assets, the interest on the long-term loans, and the various costs the bank has. Primarily, the interest they have to pay out on deposits to attract savers, plus operational costs, staff, buildings, IT, all that. This margin is basically the bank's compensation for taking on that maturity mismatch risk. Think about it. If banks could only make short-term loans funded by short-term deposits, the amount of capital available for those big, productive, long-term projects would just dry up. Economic growth would slow dramatically. So, in a way, the entire system sort of accepts this inherent fragility, because the economic benefit it provides enabling long-term investment is just indispensable. And that's why we need things like capital requirements, deposit insurance, lender of last resort, to stabilize this inherently risky but vital function.
Okay, let's nail down the accounting now. For EC3115, knowing the bank's balance sheet, that identity, it's absolutely fundamental, isn't it? It's how new money gets created. #tag2.1, identifying assets and liabilities.
Definitely. The balance sheet, you know, it's got two sides. They always have to add up to the same total. So when we talk about deposits, let's call them D. Remember, this is money the bank owes to its customers. Since it's a debt the bank has to potentially pay back instantly, deposits, D, always show up on the liability side. It's a liability of the bank.
Got it. Liabilities. And the flip side, loans, L.
Loans, L. Well, those are financial claims the bank holds against its borrowers. It's money that's owed to the bank, usually plus interest. So loans, L, always appear on the asset side of the balance sheet. And this distinction is just crucial because the total amount of money circulating in the economy is largely driven by the volume of these bank assets and liabilities. #tag2.2, the balancing condition in theory.
Okay, the fundamental rule, assets lead to liabilities, always. Let's start with a super simple theoretical case, like ignore regulations for a second.
Right. In the most basic idealized world, maybe a world with no central bank, no rules, if we assume a bank holds absolutely zero reserves and has no other weird items on its balance sheet, just deposits and loans, then the balancing requirement forces loans to exactly equal deposits. So Lala dollar equals D.
Okay, L equals D. Simple enough. Now, connect that identity to how markets work. What happens to interest rates if we assume banking is super competitive? Like banks are just scraping by, making zero economic profit.
Yeah, this is a classic result. You definitely need to remember this for the exam. In that perfect competition scenario where profits, let's call them area time, are driven down to zero, the bank's profit is just its income from loans minus its expenses on deposits. So Balikely LECZ.IL, that's loan interest earned minus deposit interest paid. Now, if we set that profit to zero, we get Larry time EJAW equal D.IDD. And since we just established that in the simple world, L must equal D, the equation simplifies dramatically. It forces the interest rate the bank charges on its loans to be exactly equal to the interest rate it pays on its deposits, IDJAW E depreciation 2. The bank basically acts as a pure pass-through. It captures zero margin on the interest rates themselves. Any profit would have to come from fees, not the spread. #tag2.3, accounting for mandatory reserves.
Okay, that's the textbook theory. Useful, but not really how it works. Because in the real world, the monetary authority steps in. They impose a mandatory reserve requirement. Let's call it $20. Mm-hmm. And that immediately changes things.
Absolutely changes things, yeah. The bank now must hold a certain fraction, $3, of its deposits as reserves. These reserves, they're either held as cash in the bank's own vault or, more commonly, as electronic balances in an account at the central bank. The balance sheet still has to balance, obviously. Assets still equal liabilities. But now these required reserves, dollar R, C, E, D, are effectively an asset the bank must hold, funded by its liabilities.
Okay, so if D is a total amount of deposits, the bank has to set aside $3 times D as reserves, which means the money that's left over, that's what they can actually lend out.
Exactly. That's the constraint. So this leads us to the new, absolutely fundamental balancing condition for a regulated bank. The amount the bank can lend, loans, L, must equal the total deposits, D, minus the required reserves, $3. And you factor out the D, you get the key identity you need to know. Lala dollar equals in below.
Right. Law dollars, 1RDD. And that toggles the lever, isn't it? If the reserve ratio to real is, say, 10% or 0.1, then the bank can only lend out 90% of every dollar deposited.
Oh.
So how does having this mandatory reserve affect that competitive equilibrium thing and the interest rates?
Well, it fundamentally creates the need for an interest rate spread because L is now strictly less than D, assuming free is greater than zero, which it always is in practice.
Right.
The bank must charge a higher interest rate on its loans than it pays on its deposits if it wants to break even, achieve zero profit. That higher I dollar is needed to cover essentially two things. First, the opportunity cost of holding those reserves. Reserves usually earn very little or no interest, so holding them is costly for the bank. And second, it covers the inherent risk premium. Remember, those loans, assets, are risky and long-term, unlike the safe short-term deposits, liabilities. So the mandatory reserve ratio, $2, is a critical piece of the regulatory plumbing. It allows the central bank to influence how much credit the banking system can create overall.
Okay, so this structure, wall dollars, 1RD, it gives the central bank two main technical ways to try and control the total money supply, right?
Yeah.
They can fiddle with the reserve ratio, $2, or they can directly control the amount of base money. #tag 3.1, controlling money supply via mandatory reserve ratios.
Yeah, historically, changing that mandatory reserve ratio, $2, was seen as a pretty powerful, though maybe blunt, tool. If the government or the central bank acting for it raises $2, it makes banks hold more reserves for every dollar of deposits. This reduces the lending capacity of the banking system, that $1 factor gets smaller. So banks are forced to hold more non-lending assets, constraining L, and theoretically that should shrink the overall money supply.
Right, sounds simple. Increased $2 money supply goes down, tighten policy. But as always in monetary economics, it seems the simple levers often have, weird, complex results. Our sources really highlight a major puzzle here. They call it the elasticity paradox. This seems important.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. This is where you need real depth for the exam, because the actual change in total deposits, and thus the money supply when $2 gets changed, is fundamentally ambiguous. It turns out it depends entirely on the shape of the demand curve for loans, specifically how elastic, how responsive borrowers are to changes in the loan interest rate. Or remember, the bank needs revenue from its loans to be able to afford to pay interest on its deposits.
Okay, let's break that down. Start with the case that seems intuitive. What if loan demand is elastic? Borrowers are really sensitive to price.
Right. So if demand for loans is elastic, borrowers react strongly to changes in the loan rate. Now, imagine the central bank increases $3. As we said, this forces banks to reduce the volume of loans they make. L falls. Because demand is elastic, price sensitive, this drop in loan volume causes a disproportionately large fall in the bank's total revenue from lending. Revenue drops significantly. To maintain their zero profit equilibrium, banks have no choice but to cut costs. Their main cost is the interest they pay depositors, so they have to cut IDBO. A lower IDBO makes holding deposits less attractive for savers, so they withdraw funds. Total deposits D fall, and therefore the money supply falls. So in this case, the policy works as intended. Increasing $2 leads to monetary tightening.
Okay, that makes sense. Now for the paradox. What if loan demand is inelastic? Borrowers aren't that bothered by higher rates.
This completely flips the result. It's quite counterintuitive. So if loan demand is inelastic, borrowers are relatively insensitive to the price, the loan interest rate.
Sure.
They need the loans anyway, maybe for critical investments. Again, the central bank raises $3. Again, this forces banks to reduce the quantity of loans, L. However, because demand is inelastic, the higher interest rate that results from the restricted supply more than compensates for the fall in volume. So the bank's total revenue from loans with pseudo.il actually increases.
Whoa. Revenue goes up even though they're lending less. Okay, so what's the competitive reaction then?
Well, in a competitive market where banks aim for zero economic profit, this extra revenue forces them really to compete more aggressively for funds. They can now afford to pay a higher interest rate on deposits. IIIIL makes deposits more attractive, incentivizing people to save more money in bank accounts. Therefore, total deposits D, and consequently the overall money supply, will actually increase, which is the exact opposite of what the central bank intended when it raised the reserve ratio.
That is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a huge complication. So the impact of raising GS dollars isn't guaranteed at all. It hinges entirely on borrower sensitivity to interest rates.
Exactly. It really underscores the complexity of the transmission mechanism and the challenge for policymakers. The actual relationship between the deposit rate, total deposits, D, the market interest rate, and the reserve ratio is governed by these derived equations in the models. And the final outcome depends crucially on the underlying parameters, like that elasticity of loan demand. For policymakers, this means they can't just assume raising your dollar tightens policy. They need good estimates of these elasticities, which are notoriously difficult to measure accurately and can change over time. It makes using your dollar a potentially unreliable tool. #TACTAC 3.2, direct control of the monetary base. High-powered money.
Okay, so given that potential ambiguity with reserve ratios, it makes sense that monetary authorities often prefer a more direct approach, controlling the foundation of the money supply, the monetary base,
right.
Some is called high-powered money. What exactly is that base?
Right, the monetary base, often labeled M0, it's the narrowest measure of money. It's the absolute bedrock. It's defined as the sum of two things. Reserves held by commercial banks, either in their vaults or at the central bank, plus physical currency, cash and coins, held by the general public, the non-bank sector. Now, the key to control here is that the central bank, like the Fed in the US, the Bank of England in the UK, the ECB in Europe, has a monopoly. It is the sole supplier of both physical currency and those reserves that banks hold on its balance sheet. They create this base money.
So how do they actually exercise this control day to day? Is it literally just deciding to print more banknotes?
Not usually through printing presses directly, no. The main mechanism, the workhorse tool, is open market operations, or MOMOs. This involves the central bank buying and selling government securities, typically government bonds, in the open market with commercial banks. This is how they manage the monetary base daily.
Okay, walk us through an example. Say the central bank wants to increase the base, maybe encourage more lending. What do they do?
Okay, to expand M0, they instruct their trading desk to buy government bonds from commercial banks or other financial institutions. When the central bank buys that bond, how does it pay for it? It simply credits the reserve account of the bank that sold the bond. This action instantly injects new reserves, brand new high-powered money, directly into the banking system. Poof, more reserves exist. With more reserves, banks find they have excess reserves above the required level, giving them greater capacity to make new loans. This kicks off the money multiplier process, expanding broader money measures like M1 and M2.
And to shrink the base, to tighten things up.
They just do the reverse. Yeah. They sell government bonds to the banks. When a commercial bank buys the bond from the central bank, it pays for it using funds from its reserve account at the central bank. So the central bank effectively drains or absorbs those reserves out of the banking system, reduces the total reserves available. This shrinks the monetary base, M0, potentially forcing banks to hold back on lending or even call in loans to meet their reserve requirements.
Right, so this feels much more direct. FOMOs give them control over the actual quantity of base money, M00, whereas fiddling with 20-row was about controlling the multiplier effect on that base.
Precisely. That's a key distinction. And furthermore, the authorities could theoretically bypass the ratio entirely. They could potentially mandate that banks hold a certain absolute level of reserves, regardless of their deposit levels, though this is less common than ratio requirements or MOMOs. But by controlling the quantity of reserves through FOMOs and managing the issuance of currency, the central bank really does have direct, quite powerful leverage over the total monetary base. It's generally considered their most effective and fine-tunable quantitative policy tool. #TACTAC 3.3, the monetary base, as an aggregate and policy indicator.
So how good are these measures, M0, M2, as actual indicators for policy? Can the central bank look at M0 growth and reliably gauge what's happening in the economy? This has been a huge debate, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Huge debate. And the empirical usefulness of these monetary aggregates, well, it seems to change depending on the time period and the policy regime in place. Our sources point to research, for instance, looking at the U.S. It found that the Board of Governors' measure of the monetary base did contain significant information about future movements in U.S. real output and inflation. Interestingly, this signal seemed particularly strong when the data included the period after 1982, quarter one. This suggests that M0, the thing the authorities can most directly control, did retain some relevance as an indicator, especially perhaps after the very volatile inflation period of the late 1970s and early 80s.
Okay, so M0 had some signal. How did that compare to broader money, like M2?
M2 actually performed quite well, too, according to that research. It seemed to contain valuable information across the entire sample period they looked at. That suggests a degree of robustness. But, and this is a big but, the same study found that many other standard monetary aggregates, maybe things like M1 or M3, depending on definitions, performed very poorly. They often contain little or no useful predictive information about the economy. Now, this finding is really significant because it directly challenges that sort of historical confidence, especially from the monetarist school, that there were stable, predictable relationships between some measure of money and the economy.
You mentioned monetarists, Friedman and Schwartz, right? For someone prepping for the exam, what's the quick takeaway from their work that this finding challenges?
Yeah, the essential context is Friedman and Schwartz famously argued, based on historical data, that there was a stable and predictable relationship between the growth of the money supply and key economic variables like nominal income, output, and prices. Their big policy prescription was basically central banks should forget trying to fine-tune the economy and just focus on ensuring steady, predictable growth in a specific monetary aggregate. The famous rules versus discretion argument stems from this. So the evidence we're discussing here, showing many of these aggregates becoming unreliable or poor predictors, suggests that the stable relationship they identified might have broken down or at least become much less reliable in more modern financial systems. It helps explain why central banks like the Fed gradually shifted their focus away from targeting monetary aggregates directly over the later decades of the 20th century. In that specific study, only M0 and M2 seemed to hold up empirically.
Okay, so moving from the theory of control levers to the, well, the messy reality of actually trying to implement policy, this is where the central banker's job must get really, really tough. They're pulling these levers based on data that, as we're finding out, might be unstable or even kind of misleading. Hashtag tag tax 4.1, the challenge of measuring money supply.
Yeah, the first massive complication is just knowing how much money is actually out there domestically. A huge structural issue, particularly for the US dollar, is the amount held outside the US, the external money supply. The flow of physical US dollars abroad used in international trade, held as savings in other countries, used as a reserve currency by other central banks. Our sources describe this flow as being large, unstable, and generally increasing over time.
Okay, so if the Fed is trying to figure out what's happening in the U.S. economy, like, is domestic demand for credit picking up? And they look at the total M0 number. They're accidentally counting potentially vast amounts of dollars stashed away in, I don't know, Panama or Russia or China. Does this flow actually distort their view that much?
It seems to create a significant blind spot, yeah. The core problem isn't just that dollars flow abroad, it's the instability of that flow relative to the total. If the ratio of foreign held currency into the total change in currency outstanding was stable and predictable, the Fed could probably adjust for it. But the sources say this ratio is large, unstable, and trending upwards, which means if you just use the raw, uncorrected money growth rates, like M0 growth, to judge domestic economic conditions, you're likely to get spurious evidence, false signals. Policymakers might see rapid M0 growth and think, uh-oh, the US economy is over. Overheating, time to raise rates. When in reality, that growth might just reflect, say, increased demand for dollars as a store of value in unstable economies elsewhere, not accelerating domestic activity at all. They're aiming at a target shrouded in fog. Hashtag tag tag 4.2 data reliability and money stock revision.
Wow. Okay. So even if we could perfectly measure the domestic money supply, ignoring the foreign part, central banks still operate using preliminary data, right? Data that gets revised later. How reliable is that initial snapshot? This brings us to that news versus noise debate about data releases.
Yeah, this is absolutely crucial for understanding the challenges of real-time policymaking. When preliminary data for any major economic variable comes out, GDP, inflation, money supply economists try to figure something out, is that first number a pretty good, efficient forecast of the final revised number? If so, the preliminary release contains genuine news about the economy. Or is that preliminary number just the true underlying value plus a large amount of random measurement error? If so, the initial release is mostly noise.
Okay, so news is good, noise is bad. What does the evidence suggest specifically for money stock data?
Well, the conclusions cited in our material are pretty damning for the reliability of short-term money stock data. The finding is that preliminary announcements of money stock figures are generally better characterized as noise, significant measurement error, rather than news or efficient forecasts. This basically means those weekly or monthly money supply numbers that get announced are often quite unreliable indicators of the true underlying trend in the very short run. And what's more, this finding implies that the subsequent revisions to the money stock data are actually somewhat predictable.
Wait, why is predictability in the revisions a bad sign? Wouldn't that be helpful?
It's problematic because it signals inefficiency in the initial estimate. If you can systematically predict how the number is going to be revised later, it means the first number wasn't the best possible forecast given the information available at the time. It was biased or systematically off. You can contrast that with, say, revisions to GMP or GDP data. Those revisions often seem largely unpredictable. They happen because genuinely new information came to light later. So GDP revisions are often seen as news. But with money stock data, the predictability of revisions suggests the initial report was just, well, a poor measurement, a noisy estimate. And the implication for policy is serious. If central bankers are making decisions week to week or month to month based on these preliminary numbers, they might often be reacting to statistical noise, not fundamental changes.
This really complicates any attempt at fine-tuning the economy using short-run discretionary policy based on money targets. Hashtag TagTag 4.3, the limits of discretionary monetary standards.
Okay, so this leads us perfectly from the technical headaches of measurement and control to, perhaps, deeper institutional problems. Even if the Fed had perfect data, knew all the elasticities, there's still this fundamental conflict between following strict policy rules versus using discretion, making it up as you go along. This is the famous time inconsistency problem, right?
Indeed it is. And this might be one of the most profound institutional challenges highlighted in modern monetary economics. It's a core concept for your exam. The idea is that policymakers who operate with full discretion, meaning they just try to do the best thing at each moment in time, optimizing their objectives period by period based on current conditions and public expectations. They find that this seemingly rational approach systematically leads to a worse outcome in the long run. Specifically, it tends to generate excessive inflation higher than what's actually optimal for society.
But why? Why does trying to be rational and optimize welfare period by period lead to a systematically bad result? What's the temptation?
The temptation arises from that old idea of a short-run trade-off between inflation and unemployment, the Phillips curve, even if only temporary. The policymaker, at any given moment, might be tempted to exploit this trade-off by engineering a little surprise inflation. The thinking is, if they can generate more inflation than the public currently expects, they can temporarily push down real wages, making firms want to hire more, and thus push unemployment below its natural long-run rate, a short-term boost.
Okay, but if the public isn't stupid, if they're rational, they should know the policymaker has this incentive, right?
Exactly. That's the core of the rational expectations argument applied here. The public anticipates the policymaker's temptation to create surprise inflation to get that temporary unemployment benefit. So knowing the policymaker's goals and incentives, the public rationally adjusts its expectations of inflation upwards. They expect the policymaker to try and inflate. Consequently, when the policymaker actually implements the inflationary policy, it's no longer a surprise. Everyone was expecting it.
Ah, so the intended effect on unemployment doesn't happen because it wasn't a surprise, but you still get the higher inflation.
That's precisely the trap. The equilibrium result is what's called an inflation bias. The average rate of inflation ends up being systematically higher than the rate that would be socially optimal, maybe zero or some low target, even though in the long run, unemployment just settles back to its natural rate anyway. The policymaker, by rationally pursuing an activist discretionary policy moment by moment, ends up achieving no lasting gain in employment but saddles the economy with persistently higher inflation. It's a profound institutional failure. Attempting to optimize continuously leads to a demonstrably suboptimal long-run outcome.
Wow, that is a paradox. A rational policymaker trying to do good actually makes things worse overall. So what's the proposed solution in the literature? How do you escape this trap?
The consensus is that outcomes generally improve only if the monetary authority's hands are tied in some credible way. They need to operate under binding rules or commitments that constrain their future policy choices, removing that temptation to go for the short-run inflationary fix. These commitments need to be credible, perhaps embedded in the central bank's legal mandate or structure, so the public believes they'll stick. Without such commitment, if you just have a fiat money system, money not backed by anything physical, operating under what our sources call the, quote, changeable and largely unfettered discretion of a monetary authority, well, that situation has been bluntly labeled a random walk monetary standard.
A random walk monetary standard. What does that imply? It sounds chaotic.
It implies exactly that. Policy actions become essentially unpredictable from the public's perspective because they depend on the hidden, shifting calculations and temptations within the discretionary authority from one period to the next. The path of policy lacks anchor. It effectively follows a random walk. This prevents the kind of stable, predictable, rule-based monetary environment that's arguably necessary for efficient long-term planning, investment, and optimal economic outcomes. The time inconsistency problem provides a very powerful theoretical argument in favor of finding ways to credibly commit to monetary rules rather than relying on pure discretion. Hashtag tag outro. Okay, so wrapping this up, let's quickly recap the absolute essential takeaways for your EC31150 exam prep. We've really covered three core pillars regarding money supply and monetary standards. First, the crucial role of banks as intermediaries hinges on maturity transformation. Remember, converting liquid deposits into illiquid loans. It's vital, but inherently risky, only made stable by regulation and confidence.
Right. Second, that key balance sheet identity for a regulated bank. $1 is a Tory's 1RDD. This shows how mandatory reserves bite into lending capacity. And crucially, don't forget the elasticity paradox. Raising salaries doesn't automatically shrink the money supply. If loan demand is inelastic, it could actually increase it. Very counterintuitive, very important. We also covered how open market operations give direct control over the monetary base, M0.
And third, the real-world application of all these tools gets incredibly messy. It's undermined by data problems and institutional issues. Data reliability is weak due to noisy preliminary numbers and those hard-to-track foreign currency flows. And even with perfect tools and data, the effectiveness of flexible policy is fundamentally limited by the time inconsistency problem. Remember, discretionary optimization can lead to that suboptimal high inflation equilibrium, a random walk monetary standard.
So what's the final thought here? What should you, the listener, be mulling over after this deep dive?
I think it's a tension between technical control and institutional commitment. Central banks have technical tools, FOMOs for M0, $3 for the multiplier, interest rate targets. But the actual stability and success of monetary policy seems to depend far less on the precision of those tools and far more on the credibility of the institution itself, its ability to commit to a predictable, non-discretionary path.
Yeah, because as we saw, the instruments themselves can have ambiguous effects, the elasticity issue. And the potential targets, like the monetary aggregates, are often unstable, noisy, or hard to measure accurately. So the unavoidable question remains, if the authorities can't always see their target clearly and their main tools have these complex, sometimes backward effects, how confident can they really be in their ability to consistently maintain a stable monetary standard without being bound by strong, credible institutional rules or commitments? It kind of forces the whole debate away from just the technical equations on the balance sheet and squarely back onto the political economy of the central bank's mandate and its ability to truly commit. Something to definitely think about.